Welcome to Afronomics, a podcast where we discuss transformative ideas for African economies in the 21st century. I'm your host, Andrew Dabalin, the World Bank Chief Economist for the Africa region. In every episode, we bring a big idea to the table and delve into a discussion on the implications for development practitioners, policymakers, and their influences, namely African citizens. So the big idea in this episode is the following. In 2024, Africa saw 7,224 public protests, more than double the number a decade ago. Citizens are demanding more from their governments, such as better services, more fairness, and stronger accountability. Today on Afronomics, we are joined by my good friend, Dr. Ken Opalo, who is an associate professor at Georgetown University School of Foreign Service. Ken's research focuses on the political economy of development, legislative politics, education reforms, and electoral accountability, particularly in East Africa, but more broadly. He's published widely, including in World Development, Governance, and the Journal of Democracy, and is the author of Legislative Development in Africa. His current work spans education reform in Tanzania, political change in Ethiopia, and local governance in Kenya. Ken earned his PhD from Stanford and his BA from Yale, and he shares sharp insights on African politics through his widely read blog, An Africanist Perspective on Substack. In this episode, we'll explore how African governments can rebuild public trust by delivering better services and strengthening accountability, a theme echoed in some of our recent publications. Ken, welcome to Afronomics. It's great to have you back.
Yeah, thank you very much, Andrew, for having me, and thanks for the generous introduction.
Excellent. So you've said, before we talk about the lots of protests, you've said in many of your conversations that it's a really, really tough time to be an African policy maker at this time. What particular challenges do African policymakers face in this period that is usually underappreciated by their critics?
Yeah, so you're right to point out that in the recent past, I've become a little bit more empathetic towards African politicians and policymakers than perhaps I was when I was younger. And that's because, you know, just looking at the problems they face and the challenges they face, right? You see a compounding of the policy failures over the last six decades. So, you know, not having invested in basic infrastructure, not having invested in human capital, not having invested in agriculture, which meant that Africa missed the Green Revolution. And then, you know, of course, not having grown the economies, right, in the 60s and 70s, or invested the windfalls from the commodity boom in the 60s and 70s, meant that, you know, at this point in history, you have the problem of not having enough fiscal space to address the failures of the last six decades, but also not having the time to be able to prioritize, you know, where to start. So they're constantly firefighting, right? So pick your favorite sector, education, right? Massive population growth over the last several decades. Means that, you know, you have lots of kids who want to attend school for free at primary, at secondary level, and now increasingly at tertiary level. So you have to worry about financing education at the primary level, have to worry about making high school free for all kids, and then have to worry about figuring out how to fund universities, because African universities and tertiary institutions remain terribly underfunded. And if you don't, kids are in the streets, right? Healthcare, right? Many people, you know, want basic care through national programs, right? If you fail to do that, people may be in the streets because the health sector is not working, right? Ag, right? If you don't do enough irrigation or do enough fertilizer distribution, food prices go up, people may be in the streets, right? So across the board, you know, you have this compounding effect of accumulated problems that are coming to a head. And I think this is being compounded by the fact that now lots of people are more educated, lots of people are more urban, right? Ag as a safety valve is no longer there as a provider of employment, or perhaps livelihoods for families is no longer a viable strategy for many African households. And so for more than half of Africans, right, you have to work to live in the cities. And if that is not working out, then government has to answer for that in the form of protests or some sort of instability. And so, you know, faced with all these problems, right, I think African policymakers don't have the time or the resources to figure out, you know, how to solve for any of these comprehensively, which is why I empathize with them.
If I may, you haven't mentioned the fact that this gets even more complicated because there's going to be a looming demographic bulge, right?
Oh, yeah. Yes.
And that makes demand for services really snowball and skyrocket, right?
Yeah. I mean, just a quick perspective, right? So when I did my KCSE, the secondary school certificate here in Kenya, I think my class had about 200,000 kids or so graduating high school. The typical class in Kenya now is close to 1 million, right? So, you know, from a government's perspective, that's a fivefold increase, and you have to worry about that, right? And those are kids that will demand jobs when they leave high school, or if they go to tertiary institutions when they leave college. So, you know, lots of challenges coming down the pike.
How much of these particular failures in service delivery do you attribute to complexity of the problem? And how much of it is really like just the fact that there have been policy failures by African policymakers?
Huh. The easy answer here is that it's both. But if you pin me to the wall, right, I think I would lean in the direction of policy failures and, you know, repeated inability to learn from those failures. Because I think, you know, let's take education as an example, right? Yes, the 80s and early 90s happened, the debt problems, the need for structural adjustment and all that. But I think by the late 90s, African governments should have sat back and actually crafted growth strategies that would have immensely benefited from the commodity boom that was occasioned by China's rise, right? And that would have meant, you know, using the windfalls to do more on ag, using the windfalls to be more strategic in terms of expanding education access, bringing down the cost of healthcare, and basically taking care of, you know, the urbanization trends. But what we saw was, you know, the lack of strategic thinking coming out of the crisis of the 80s meant that many basically took bets on the commodity boom by not having their own strategies, but by, you know, having this wishful, being captive to the wishful thinking sort of mode of, we'll build infrastructure and something will happen out of it, right? So we'll build a bunch of roads and do a lot of visible and attributable development, but without any clear sort of strategic thinking behind it. Now, you know, there are a few countries that actually had plans, development plans, but, you know, very few consistently implemented those plans. And to a large extent, right, much of the growth in the early 2000s, right to about 2014, was commodity driven and also driven by government spending. And so when the commodity boom ended, government spending, you know, sputtered, and therefore growth stopped. So, you know, yes, the problems are complex, not least because there are problems everywhere. But I think, you know, that has always been true for all countries that have escaped poverty. And so I think for African countries, the challenge was that many basically did not step up to the plate to, you know, match the problems that they were facing.
In a way, some of these policy failures and the lack of service delivery and the dissatisfaction with them have been very costly, right? Some have led to basically state collapses. When you look at the landscape of African states and you see, you know, how some of them have basically collapsed, is there some general kind of mistakes that these states have made that others need to be aware of? Or are all these just the idiosyncrasies to the particular states that have basically not managed their situation well?
Yeah, so if I could sort of pinpoint a general pattern, it's that when a good share of the citizenry basically loses faith in the national project, right, the state loses legitimacy, which then, you know, gives people very few options but to look for alternatives to the state, right? I think the decline of state legitimacy, which I think is a function of states' inability to deliver basic public goods and services, including security, right? Leaves people looking for options outside of the state. Now, in some contexts, that has meant, you know, just exit from the state sort of directed systems. In others, it's meant looking for alternatives to the state in the form of, you know, violence entrepreneurs. I think the erosion of legitimacy. Now, you know, in some contexts, it's because of poor economic circumstances coupled with, you know, a failure of political accountability to be seen to be working. In others, it's basically severe collapse of state capacity to deliver on security, but also coupled with this question of, you know, accountability and legitimacy, right? So, you know, if you look at the Sahel, yes, the collapse of Libya basically accelerated the problem. But, you know, the problem of Sahelian states' inability to take care of their citizens was always going to be a problem, even if Libya hadn't collapsed to sort of create this extremely heightened security problem that we're experiencing now. In less violent places, right, you see it in the form of protests, declining support for incumbent governments, you know, citizens sense that governments lack legitimacy, this general dissatisfaction with governments, right? Mm. In last year's elections, you know, there was a wave of incumbent losses in Africa, right? Very few survived. Incumbent parties in Mozambique and Namibia survived because, you know, essentially hegemonic parties, but almost everywhere, including Botswana, right? The BDP lost. And so you know, that's the trend is general that governments are not doing enough on multiple dimensions to satisfy the citizens.
There was a lot of hope that was placed on democracy, right? This idea that the transition to democracy, open competition, political pluralism. So in your hat as a comparative political scientist, how do you grade the performance of democracy in the continent as of today?
I'd give it a C in general. If we include, say, the top five performers, right, I would give it a C. But in general, right, in most places, it's an F for the simple reason that the theory of change that everyone had in mind was not well thought out, right? So the theory of change was that the problem is accountability. We introduce elections. Elections will bring accountability. And therefore, create incentives for building capacity of the state, right, to provide the public goods and services, and two, improve the quality of public goods and services provided by the state. Now, if you unpack that causal chain, right, you quickly realize that elections are not a good way to incentivize state building, right? Because with elections come five-year, 4-year cycles, extreme short-termism, right? A structural disincentive against making tough choices. And so, you know, who wants to build a state whose rewards will be experienced 10 years down the road, right? What you do is you do the spot exchanges that you need to win the next election, right? And so I think that's where the causal mechanism, you know, basically failed. And the failure was catastrophic, right? Because in some cases, you saw an actual erosion of state capacity over the last 30 years as countries got more competitive electorally, right? So Zambia, for example, you know, parts of Ghana, I mean, even here in Kenya, you see in some parts of Kenya where there's actually erosion of government's ability to do things that it used to be able to do because of the short-termism of elections. And then on the quality side, right, it's also not clear that elections are the best way to produce high quality. So, you know, I think a lot about education. And if you think about the quality in education, it's not easily visible, right? You know, grades are private at the individual level. Parents are more likely to attribute A's to their own effort or their kids' high IQ than some government policy. And so politicians will more likely than not invest in, you know, visible stuff, buildings, maybe teachers, but not high quality, right? So even there, you know, elections don't really get you where you want to be. And so, you know, I think elections are a good mechanism when the systems are working. But if the systems are not working, then elections do something completely different, which is, you know, provide a legitimation process for holding power, or, you know, establish queuing systems for, you know, when everyone gets their turn, as opposed to being, you know, a mechanism for incentivizing both state building and quality improvement.
So let's stay with that. So, and yet Africans somehow by plurality of majorities prefer democracy over authoritarianism, even though that preference has kind of been eroded over time. But this, it started from a very high level and still relatively high. I mean, more than 50% of this majorities still prefer that. And we're stuck with these systems now, right? So how do you then incentivize better state building when the process you have, which is democracy, which is electoral, is the incentives that, you know, the process you have basically incentive or rewards short-termism, right? So how would you design something different that actually incentivizes better state building, better institutional strengthening, and so on and so on? How would you do that?
I mean, the best way to do it is to invent a time machine and go back to the 60s, right? And use that authoritarian era to build states pre-early 90s. So short of that, I can only speculate. One sort of potential pathway is to invest in strong political parties that can hold power over time, right? Because I think one of the sort of pathologies of African democracy is that people have often prized turnover over quality of democracy, right? So, you know, my fellow political scientists are just as guilty on this measure. You know, we often think of, you know, the best election is the one in which the incumbents lose, right? Because it's competitive and whatnot. But, you know, turnover is overrated, right? Turnover can also be a sign of extreme institutional instability or extreme inability of incumbents to deliver. Because ideally, incumbents should be able to deliver enough to win re-election. There should be an incumbency advantage when the system is working, which is true, you know, in many high-income countries, there's incredible amounts of incumbency advantage because the systems work to deliver. And so parties may serve to sort of elongate collective time horizons so that within the party, yes, individuals may have short-term ambitions, but they have to pursue those ambitions within the wider context of thinking beyond the next election. And I think that may be a way to then lock in incentives to think more long-term with regard to state building and implementing national development strategies. The other sort of perhaps less grounded idea might be to just have more frank conversations about democracy, right, in the region. Because I think for the longest time, there was a taboo against having even a conversation like we're having, right? That, you know, this is a great thing, but is it really working as intended in the region, right? So having more of these conversations to bring to the open, right, the challenges that come with electoral competition, and then perhaps, you know, crafting elite coalitions, even in the absence of strong parties, to sort of ring fence certain areas that are not open to politicization. And I think that's doable, right? Elite pacts can be had so that, you know, say the security sector, you know, gets ring fenced so that you can have, you know, a strong, capable security architecture, for instance, that, you know, serves as the backbone of the state and allows for, you know, peace and stability and all these things that are crucial for development. Because otherwise, right, there's a real sort of possibility of just running around in circles without building the architecture needed to make democracy actually work.
You and I come from Kenya, and we had a period when KANU was the dominant party, and there was a lot of dissatisfaction, right? And you can see that across the board, right? You see that in Mozambique, you see that in Tanzania already. You know, there are seeds of dissatisfaction about this dominance by one party. And so, yet at the same time, you know, I can see the point you're making, which is that, okay, so you really need strong parties that try and invest in building state, structures and deliver services at the same time. Where citizens at the same time really like revolting against these structures.
I think it's not just the party, it's the party, the ideology, elite behavior within the party that buys you the goodwill, right, for citizens to allow you to stay on and build, you know, this long-term vision. In the other dominant parties, what you've seen is erosion of support for the dominant parties after they were seen to veer off the track of, you know, the social contract that underpinned popular support for the parties. So, you know, corruption in Mozambique, you know, most significantly the Tuna Bond scandal. Even Angola, right, the MPLA, you know, has suffered because of perceived corruption. SA with the ANC, again, perceived corruption and inability to deliver. So I think if the government can deliver, right, my conception of this sort of solution is a dynamic one whereby you create the organizational mechanism for long-term thinking, but then you invest heavily in buying legitimacy by actually delivering, right? Because I think the real mechanism here is service delivery, which then buys you legitimacy and some goodwill to make tough choices on state building, right? And you know, maybe I should emphasize this point, right? So the best way to solve for this problem right now, given the impatience coming from the public, is to buy time and room, right, to make tough choices on state building. Because state building will not be rewarded politically. Often that means, you know, spending more on the military, spending more on a more expensive bureaucracy, and all and raising taxes, right, to create some fiscal space, things that citizens will not like. How do you do that? You do that by, you know, convincing citizens either via ideology or service delivery, right? You buy the goodwill by actually delivering on specific public goods and services. Now, if you could do that without a strong party, like what we have here in Kenya, which is basically a partyless democracy, well and good, yeah. But it's really hard to do it, right? You need an organizational mechanism to align incentives. So, you know, this is the reason why I think, you know, maybe dominant parties have a slight advantage in the sense that they can discipline their own elites and how they do politics and keep focus on these longer term visions.
So if you look at the history of democracy in the world, and especially in Europe, where it took root early, this was something that is centuries long kind of process, right? Like it started with, I don't know, whatever it was, then it became feudalism, then there was a monarchy, then there was something in between, lots of revolutions, and eventually people settled on this stuff, right? So sociologically, these societies have had a long period of trying to experiment on things and be able to settle on something that they thought would work for their society, right? To flourish. But what you see now is this import, it's very short term, that is grafted onto existing structures, right? And I wonder sometimes whether, again, this comes to your sympathy for African elites, right? Whether they're trying to understand a technology that is actually foreign and difficult, and they're trying to make the best of it. So you've said, like, okay, fine, but is this what we have now, right? So we kind of stuck with this technology and we have to make it work. So how do you see how the path out of this kind of tension in Africa between the traditional systems that people recognize and this import that is now grafted onto it, that is actually putting a lot of strains in policymaking, but also in politics in general? How do you see the politics in Africa, which is essential for policymaking, to evolve in this environment?
Yeah, this is a great question. I think looking back, say, over the last 60 years, right, the places where democracy has actually taken root well are places where elites themselves, right, domesticated democratic processes. so that, you know, what happened is what happened in Europe, which is countries democratized on elite terms, right? So I think you know, democracy only works if elites actually buy into it, right? Otherwise, you know, it'll be a facade and enough of them will be trying to undermine it, in which case it doesn't really work, right? You know, the US currently is a good example. It's really hard to have democracy without elite buy-in, right? And so I think what happened in most of Africa is that in the early 90s, democracy arrives basically almost as an external tool of disciplining African elites, right? As opposed to a system that's widely accepted by African elites who then adopt it on their own terms. And so right off the bat, right, the people championing democracy are the oppositionists and the incumbents are against it. So you miss the sort of policy mix needed to make democracy work well because the oppositionists, actually many did not have good policies, right? Opposition policy was simply to get rid of the incumbent. So like from the get-go, there was never a robust policy debate around this technology, right? And so I think what may help moving forward, right, I would argue is one, you know, if we continue to have more robust and open conversations about the challenge, maybe we can arrive at a point where we design institutions in ways that are sympathetic to elite interests, right, or views, right, so that they're within the tent and see this as a legitimate way of running things, as opposed to always imagining that democracy can be a way to discipline them and having them outside of the system. If you ask me, right, this was also a big failure of the democracy promotion wave, right, of the last 30 or so years, right? It was always couched as outside coming in to discipline African politicians, right? And with all kinds of institutions sort of around it, right? As opposed to, you know, empathizing and understanding where these elites come from, are coming from. And perhaps thinking through, okay, given the reality, including African histories, right? And perceptions of, you know, the norms around governance, right? How can we cultivate that into the governing systems that African countries adopted? And then I think finally, the other sort of people that need to be a little bit empathetic here are, you know, the pro-democracy people on the continent. I think we all need to also, you know, sit back and ask, you know, how can we contribute more to, you know, cultivating more homegrown conceptions of democracy and how it should work. And I can see how, you know, say local government, right, can be a conduit for localizing practice of democracy, right? So that people can practice democracy at the local level, so that when we get to the national level, you know, the right kinds of norms have already been inculcated and people see democracy in action in their daily lives at the local level. Because that's something, again, that's missing because of weak state capacity. The link, and you see this in the surveys, right? Voters' link between votes and service delivery is not as tight as it could be. Often gets short-circuited by identity and other things. But that's because there is not enough capacity to deliver the service to allow for the sort of creation of that link in the mental models of how democracy works. So localization may be a good way to go.
Is there a place where you see this set of ideas taking root in the continent, which could become, you know, a kind of a space for having this conversation, right? These retrospective conversations about, okay, you know, we've tried this import, this technology for 30 years. Now, we've learned a lot about what works, what doesn't. And so, you know, we need to rethink how to become, I guess, as you say, how to modernize our institutions based on what we've learned and based on all the technologies that have, you know, we have, both traditional and imports.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's, I guess Botswana is a good place because so they succeeded in domesticating it very rapidly at the national level, in part because of, you know, the fact that they maintain their parliamentary system. So I think that was a good tool for them to craft their parliamentary system onto their traditional forms of authority. I think, you know, having organizations that reach people where they work and live is a good way to demonstrate that, you know, it pays to belong to X organization or it pays to be part of a democratic system.
Excellent. So let's switch to another topic that you and I have talked about in the past. I mean, you've been very clear that the solution to a lot of these problems of service delivery, you know, this dissatisfaction by citizens about, you know, elites and their ambitions and delivery is growth. And the fact that African growth so far has not delivered. And yet that is really the route to societies flourishing and these service delivery problems to be sorted out. How do you incentivize African policymakers to really pay attention to growth and the particular type of growth, of course, which is one that creates jobs and provides opportunities for citizens?
Yeah, I think the best incentive is to make it normatively okay for them to benefit from that growth.
They're already benefiting from the system they have, right? There's lots of corruption. There's a lot of rent extraction. What is the additional thing you need to give them to see, okay, actually growth is better than what you have now, right?
Yeah, I think it's to sort of show them that there's massive upside that, you know, even with what they're getting now, they're still only getting crumbs in terms of, you know, the global scale. And perhaps to illustrate this point, right, think of the DRC, right? So I think it's a massive puzzle that we don't have more dollar billionaires out of the DRC, right? Right. I think mm-hmm. the DRC should have a lot more dollar billionaires than perhaps the one. I think Katumbi may be close, but not really, right? Why is that? That's because the system that they have now, right, allows for rents. Yes, 20 million here, 50 million there. But not at the scale of owning a commodity company that can actually create that amount of wealth for Congolese individuals, right? And the reason why that's not the case is because of the norms around the management of Congolese wealth, right? So one, you know, it's always been that the government has to own the resources and not individuals, right? And if that's the case, then government officials can only get rents. Meanwhile, the people making a killing are foreign companies operating in the DRC. So there's a normative aversion to African elites actually making wealth, especially around African resources, which I think stunts the likelihood of growth in the region. Because if they're limited to rents, then the games they'll play will involve, you know, making outsiders rich as they get the crumbs. And also the forms of corruption they'll engage in are forms of corruption that do not circulate the windfalls within the economy, right? So, you know, in my hypothetical world where there are, say, 7 Congolese billionaires, they also own conglomerates that are maybe related or not to their mining activities that they're doing. And Congo then has a much bigger economy, right? And you can extrapolate this view into even ag or services in the region, whereby the rentier mindset, you know, very much predominates because if you look at a typical sort of policy reform program, it's often designed to be very neutral without any specific interest group in mind that's designed to benefit from the policy, right? So, you know, and if that's the case, then, you know, why should I care about a policy if I can put you guys on the spot, if the World Bank insists that it has to be neutral, right? If there's no one to benefit from the policy, there's no one who will stay up at night to make sure that it works, right?
If I may push you, Ken, here. So what stops, I mean, why don't they see it? Why don't they have the mindset like the one you just described? So I couldn't, you know, Congo is an excellent example, as you've given, but I could mention several others, cocoa in West Africa, yeah. Right?
Yep, yep.
And so on and so on. What stops these elites from actually appropriating the mechanisms for creating wealth using these enormous resources they're sitting on? Why are they not coalescing around, okay, this is, we're picking up crumbs, but we could actually be having the cake and whatever, right?
And
and use it for social purposes, whatever, right? Why don't they do it?
I think ideas, right? Ideas are powerful, right? And especially when they're backed by institutions. And so, you know, I think one obvious answer here is that the elites who run African countries, one, they're products of schools and schools of thought that have very specific ideas about what it takes to develop, right? Or what it takes to reform an economy. And then I think also they're part of an international system that also has very strict expectations about what's legitimate action by a state, right? And so if you're Ghana, for example, right? If you're Ghana, you know, for the longest time, the best you were allowed to do, right? Allowed here, meaning both in terms of the rigidity of thought, but also in terms of the policy options made available to you, were to reduce corruption in Cocoa Board, right? But reducing corruption in Cocoa Board, you know, last time I checked, you know, Ghanaian farmers get about 6% of the price of a bar of chocolate. So even if you were to completely clean up the process, right, you'd still only get 6%. 94% is accruing to European companies, commodity traders, and all sorts of middlemen, right? And so I think you know, we need to expand the aperture of what's feasible as policymakers to think of, okay, what if Ghana, right, if Cocoa Board, say, acquired a commodity trading company, that would capture a lot more of the value of chocolate, even before we get to, you know, manufacturing chocolate in Ghana, right? Mm. Because then you can begin to set prices and dictate, you know, how much money you get. But that's just not part of the thinking, because the thinking is government officials are corrupt, so we need to ring fence Cocoa Board and make sure that farmers get their share of the external price, end of story. And so, you know, the pool of resources available gets very limited. So I think most of the challenge on this score is just ideas, right? Ideas of what they can do, and also having the intellectual backing when they do this, right? And then finally, I think there's also a risk aversion, right? So, you know, there's legitimate fear that if you make your Dangotes of the world, they'll become monopolists. But, you know, I think that's a risk worth taking. I don't think Africans are uniquely monopolist. And I don't think Africa will have a uniquely different path to economic takeoff than we've seen elsewhere, where, you know, growth happens when local farms get big and actually become the platforms for foreign investment, right? As opposed to foreign resource extraction, which is the play you see all around the continent.
Okay, so there is the international constraints, but how much of it is lack of elite, domestic elite unity and consensus, right? I mean, and this is where, again, we come back to this democracy, which is adversarial. It's all about, I want to get into power. And there isn't a kind of a unified mindset that this is the way we will have to manage these resources, right? That we're going to actually take the risk on having these big conglomerates develop, as they did in East Asia, right? They basically kind of took the risk, whether it was South Korea or Japan or something like that, that this is what we'll do. How much of this is basically, again, the interplay of the international constraints, the lack of a political structure that allows for these kinds of policy space to emerge?
Yeah, I mean, certainly electoral competition doesn't help, right? Because you can see how, you know, a would-be mining company can contribute to a campaign, right? And that becomes the windfall for the political class as opposed to actually owning the resource and exploiting it themselves. And then it also breeds, you know, a lack of intra-elite trust, which I think kind of, you know, comes even before the electoral competition itself, right? I think many African countries in the post-colonial era, immediate post-colonial era, missed the boat on strong nation building. So that, you know, there's a lot of inter-ethnic mistrust in ways that, you know, quite frankly, these days still surprise me, even as a political scientist, right? Because, you know, you'd want sometimes to believe that elites only use identity instrumentally to win elections, but because of the geographic concentration of ethnic groups and the nature of political competition, there's a lot of mistrust, which means that it's really hard to get a national agenda going across identity groups or across regions, which then means that only countries that have, you know, explicitly tried to solve for this problem are able to actually have long-term visions.
Indeed. And with an elite pact, which basically brings in all these ethnic elites together and kind of forges this mentality about wealth creation and building conglomerates, is that possible in the environments we have? And if not, how do you engineer such a thing?
I think to get people thinking about growth, right, we need to work on, you know, creating sort of ideas about what it takes to grow, right? Getting people comfortable with the idea of growth and development, right? Because growth will come, you know, in the form of massive amounts of wealth creation, including for individuals, right? Which, you know, to be frank with you, I think many people on the continent, especially African intellectuals who, you know, shape opinion on how people think about growth and development, are still a little bit queasy about individuals amassing wealth, right, as part of the growth process. And so that also needs to be worked on to create the normative structure for growth, because it will mean big farms creating lots of jobs. People who own those farms will accumulate lots of wealth. But it'll also mean, right, creating sort of permission structures for people to think that this is a risk worth taking. So, you know, we really need to work on the idea side, because for the better part of 60 years, right, the ideas that were sort of sold to these elites actually took hold, right? Because people take ideas seriously, and the growth paths that were made available to them, or that were made to think were available to them, have proven not to be as good as they could have been. And so I think if enough people get onto the growth train, right, so that we always push on the question of, you know, what's the big picture transformational growth agenda, then we can stop, you know, the faddist sort of veneration of nano development and think big picture and allow countries to make mistakes and learn from those mistakes.
Excellent. So let me then ask this last question, which, and you and I have talked a little bit in the past, but I think it'll be good for maybe our listeners to get your views on this, which is, okay, all these require, we've talked about the fact that everyone, you know, ideas are important, right? And, you know, the role of ideas in you know, growth is really about new ideas that we agree and we share. But there is a lot of lack of policy autonomy, which you have mentioned, we have talked a lot about in your actually Substack, in this environment where at the same time there are lots of geopolitical, you know, challenges. There is a lot of research that was funded by outsiders, right? Whether those are bilateral aid groups or even, you know, joint research groups coming mostly from Europe or North America. And that is changing, right? So what do you see as the way forward now for these countries to craft a policy space that is autonomous, but also a research environment that is going to speak to these kinds of ideas about wealth creation and the form in which it should take?
Net of everything, right? I see the current moment is presenting a good opportunity for a reset, right? So the decline of aid has sort of severed good chunk of, you know, part of this external constraint sort of architecture, because, you know, having to pay attention to donors all the time and their priorities meant that African policymakers were not focused on the realities on the ground, right? And weren't thinking long-term about their own situation. And so I think there is an opportunity here, one, to think more with eyes looking inward as opposed to outward to donors, right? So instead of the cultural policy extroversion, actually trying to understand the objective realities on the ground, you know, less attention to SDGs. Shocked that this is the first time I'm mentioning SDGs. Okay. I think, you know, policymakers should pay less attention to SDGs and more attention to their objective realities and what they want to do for their countries. Set their bars much higher in terms of ambition. And then, you know, I think whatever's left of the aid sector should do more to curate knowledge production in context. Because I think policy only works if it's informed by objective realities on the ground, right? Instead of, you know, learning in Chile and then trying to scale globally, right? And people will tell you all about, you know, their localization efforts, but that seldom happens, right?
Mm.
What happens is policymakers expect that, oh yeah, if you're a donor coming with lots of money, you know what you're talking about, and therefore you can, you will succeed if you adopt this, you know, off-the-shelf policy from Chile. So local knowledge production, and especially policy-relevant knowledge production, will be key to success. Because then, you know, that process will generate the right ideas for context. Because even within Africa, right, there won't be an African path, right? Each country will have its own idiosyncrasies and therefore will need its own path, so to speak.
And yet what we see is that a lot of this aid, whatever is left of it, or in the way in which it has been reformed, is now going to basically try and promote the national interests of these countries that provide aid, right? Is there any sense of believing that the national interest of these countries is to create local knowledge in these countries? I mean, so if that is not the case, where should the funding for research and ideas and policy autonomy in these countries come from?
Yeah, so here's my sort of running theory of change now. I think an era where the national interest of donors is explicit allows for us to point out that, you know, aid is not, you know, a gift. It comes with interests attached to it. So if you want to succeed, you either align with those interests, or if you're not aligned with those interests, you should figure out, you know, alternative strategies. I think that case was harder to make back when, you know, aid seemed like it was all good, right? And, you know, I mean, it's often I hear people say, well, you know, of course policymakers need, but, you know, sometimes I doubt it, right? Because I remember seeing a picture of, you know, Kenyan policymakers in the security sector, no less, getting a gift of printers and computers from a country that shall not be named, right? It's like, you know, how can you accept such as electronics as a gift in your security system, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, I think people actually believe that, you know, aid is benevolent. So I think moving to a world where we explicitly acknowledge that the interest behind aid allows for internal conversations about, you know, one, either explicitly aligning with the foreign interests, you know, sometimes that may be beneficial. Or if not, you know, crafting your own domestic agenda. And I think, you know, in the spirit of open conversation, right, the more we're explicit about what we're doing, the better for everyone involved. And I think it will also allow donors to learn a few things about the countries that they operate in. Because, you know, I think maybe being in Nairobi, I've seen what I would characterize as a real shift in thinking about aid, right? I haven't seen the hue and cry, at least from official DOM, that I see from aid workers, right? They seem to be a lot less alarmed than I would have expected, which means that, you know, maybe they're throwing the previous beneficiaries of aid under the bus. And it's true that many people will suffer as a result of the aid cuts. But it could also mean that, you know, countries like Kenya can actually absorb the cost hit for the most part. And therefore, you know, what will be left is to figure out how do you make the systems work that were previously being supported by outsiders. That then gives you room to have these internal conversations about, you know, making aid fit into your own agenda as opposed to constantly chasing the agenda of donors.
Fantastic. Ken, thanks so much for this rich and timely conversation. I think that's a good place to end. I hope that, in fact, African policymakers are learning and that in the next few years, we're going to begin to see policy autonomy and new ideas about how to grow and create wealth. So you've helped us unpack not just the challenges, but also the opportunities for governments across Africa to rebuild trust and deliver for their citizens. And to our listeners, if today's discussion resonated with you, I encourage you to dig into the latest country policy and institutional assessments that we did in this office. And for more sharp, unfiltered analysis, be sure to check out Ken's blog, An Africanist Perspective. It's one of the best sources out there for commentary on African politics, institutions, and development trends. Thank you for tuning in to Afronomics. Until next time, please check us at worldbank.org/Afronomics. Thank you and see you next time.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.